You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
And a very warm welcome back to Solidarity Breakfast.
A left response to the major developments in capitalism.
What they trade in is not wheat. They trade in famine.
A little dose of revolutionary optimism.
I think it's really important to sort of express solidarity globally.
It really is a deal by corporations for corporations.
The union forever defending our rights. Down with the black leg.
If you think the ABC's left wing, don't listen to this program.
Solidarity Breakfast, 7:30 to 9 a.m. Saturdays, 3CR, 8:55 a.m. Streaming and 3CR digital, podcast or audio on demand. And of course, the website, solidaritybreakfast.org.au.
Solidarity forever!
Good morning, everybody. And this is Annie, our newest member of the team, Matt. G'day, Matt. How are you?
Good. It's good. Great to be here amongst all the listeners. And thanks for tuning in, everyone.
Yeah, isn't it cold outside?
It is. It's a little bit cold.
It's massively cold. So hopefully if you're listening to us, you're nice and doonered up. Of course, we should give our reflections over to people who are homeless, and also remember that the Victorian state government wants to knock down public housing estates, and that the other constituents around Australia are also similarly being attacked by their governments as developers prime themselves to take over land that previously wasn't considered to be likeable, but now, of course, it's in a city and bespoke, and everybody wants it. So, of course, the cold weather is particularly hard on people who are out in the streets or in their cars. Being moved on, spare a thought, and be political and push back. That's our message regarding public housing. There's been a variety of things to report. What were some of the things on your radar, Matt?
It was just yesterday. The Guardian reported that actually New South Wales government has spent nearly $500,000 on court cases that they've lost against pro-Palestine protest groups, in particular Palestine Action Group in Sydney. And in fact, I'm just looking at the report now. And in fact, the final bill to the taxpayer is yet to be finalised. Now, a lot of this has come about because of we saw the really, really egregious scenes with the police abusing and really hitting protesters who were rallying against the visit of Isaac Herzog in February. The state's Court of Appeal actually struck down the laws in April after finding they impermissibly burdened the implied constitutional right to freedom of political communication. And this is a very important point. The state of New South Wales actually had a cost order granted against it. So the three activist groups which were represented in the court case had their legal bills paid by the state of New South Wales.
Which is sort of fascinating, isn't it? It's sort of like, please explain why you're attacking your citizens.
There is that, and which is disturbing enough. But what I really find disturbing is, according to this report by The Guardian yesterday, Chris Minns was of the view that the laws were valid.
Oh, that's interesting, isn't it? So, he hasn't been charged with contempt of court, which is interesting in itself. It does remind me of a thing. Oh no, I won't say it. It's too inflammatory. I won't. It's just that when you think of scary and aggressive people, you don't usually think of people in suits that are nice and neat, do you? Which is what Minns likes to project. But obviously, there's more to that.
Yep. And I think just to expand on that, the legal consequences. There's a nice quote from Professor Emerata in Constitutional Law, University of Sydney. Professor, that's Anne Toomey, and she said she gave this warning. History tells us that anti-protest laws rushed through Parliament often have an unhappy ending in the courts. So that's something to consider when legislation that is rushed through and ill-considered and not given appropriate consultation at leads to draconian measures, as we've seen in Sydney and also in Queensland.
Also it does tell you about the balance between and the separation of powers, which is one of the three things that are required for corruption. You have to suborn your courts, you have to suborn the government, and you have to suborn the police. They're the three areas of concern. And so it's a good sign, actually, that this has come to fruition in this way. One of the good signs, there's a certain robust nature to the Australian democracy if this case has been thrown out of court effectively. Another one of those kind of things is the Australian All Work reports, you put this in the hat, that the Australian Commonwealth Bank reversed customer service job cuts after an AI voice system struggled to handle call volumes and customer needs, prompting the bank to restore positions. IBM also found limits to automation after deploying AI to manage most routine human resources requests. While AI now handles the majority of standard inquiries, the company said more complex situations still require human judgment. And it was the little bit at the end that really got me. IBM, this is how it was expressed, IBM has since announced plans to significantly increase entry-level hiring in the United States, citing the need to maintain a future talent pipeline.
Yes, that corporate speak again, that really erodes the language, the English language.
Yeah, but also the place of humans within it.
Yeah.
And it brings in the local resentment now around this holus bolus creation of data centres all around the place, which effectively are being built to not only spy on people but take their jobs.
Yeah, and an important thing to note is that these data centres are not like the data centres that started to exist around about 10 years ago, because they used to generate power for search engines. These data centers use vast amounts of water, gas, and land. And the whole thing is, I was listening to a mainstream media during this week, and they had a really good analysis. That's actually Thursday's episode of mainstream media of AI. And they actually pointed out that the actual business case, the actual valuation in these AA companies, it seems that it's overvalued.
Yeah, they are. It's a scam.
And to paraphrase Scott Mitchell, what he was saying, it's like as if that they are developing a user case. Like they don't actually have like a proof of concept as such. You know, the investment is going to generate, that they say, is going to generate something.
Yeah. Basically they have to sucker everybody into believing that it's inevitable. And obviously the people who are in the governments, very few of the people who are representing us seem to have done their due diligence. This has been going on for quite a while, because I've been to a couple of big end of town stuff about this for over the last decade, because it started off with it's inevitable and it's going to be the big new industrial revolution. Now, the interesting thing about the industrial revolution that happened, our history books generally call it a bonanza and brings us to our present level of wealth. A certain part of the world's wealth, which has been siphoned off by almost every other parts of the world, have siphoned off into a group of European states. But the level of pain and anguish and death that was caused by that industrial revolution, maybe someone's quantified it. But obviously, for a lot of humanity, what has resulted is not a rosy picture, effectively. It's not a rosy picture, and you'd have to think about what they're now going to expect ordinary people to have to sacrifice for the next industrial revolution, even if it is, you know, a huge con. You know, it's a con, effectively. It's been created as a con. It requires the people who are being conned to accept it as an inevitability. That's my point. It's a bit disturbing. I'll tell you something else that's a bit disturbing. According to the McDonald's loses lawsuit against Chef Jamie Oliver, who's fighting the good fight, who proved that the food they sell is unfit for human consumption because it is highly toxic. Oliver demonstrates how hamburgers are made. According to Oliver, fatty cuts of meat are washed, in inverted commas, with ammonium hydroxide and then used to fill the hamburger patties. Even before this process, the TV presenter says this meat was unfit for human consumption. Oliver, and he's called a radical activist chef, I think he's just a person who is a qualified chef and is on humanity's side. We are talking about meat that is sold as dog food and then served to humans. Aside from the quantity of the meat, ammonium hydroxide is harmful to health. What sane person would put a piece of meat soaked in ammonium hydroxide into a child's mouth? In another initiative, Oliver demonstrated how chicken nuggets are made. After the best parts, in inverted commas, are selected, the rest, fat, skin, cartilage, eyes, bones, head, feet, is subjected to a mechanical separation process called caniska, a euphemism used by food engineers. This blood pink paste, which is deodorized, bleached, refreshed and recolored, it is then coated in flour and deep fried. It is typically fried in partially hydrogenated oils, in other words, toxic substances. The food industry uses ammonia hydroxide as a microbial agent, allowing McDonald's to use meat in its hamburgers that is unfit for human consumption. Even more alarming, however, is the fact that these ammonia hydrogen pass substances are considered legal components of the production process in the global food industry with the approval of health authorities. Consequently, consumers will never know what substances are in their food. Scared?
It doesn't sound like it's fit for human consumption.
You know what? I have never in my life bought anything except a smoothie from McDonald's ever. I've never eaten a McDonald's thing ever.
Oh, I think growing up, I probably went to McDonald's for like the Happy Meals and things like that. But no, I haven't. I don't go there because that's just not healthy food to eat, basically.
Be scared. Be very scared. Yeah. The other thing that I wanted to talk about was this thing about, I went to a rally recently. It was the rally that the council workers were doing, and I was having a chin wag with the pretty cynical guy who does the sound systems. Because, you know, over time I've had I get to know these people and, you know, he's a nice guy and we have a yarn and he has political views. But what he was saying, he said this thing that was quite interesting to me, which was that, oh, you know, of course these people don't get enough money, but, you know, if their wages go up, then of course it's a vicious cycle. Inflation just continues. And I thought, that's interesting, because that's the common belief, that increased wages is the cause of inflation. And I thought I'd let you hear a contrary view. In fact, this is exactly, you know, of course, the argument runs that by asking for better wages, workers are the fuelers of inflation, at fault for their wages cuts, because a below inflation wage increase is a wages cut, you know, because if you don't get more than the inflation, then you're actually not getting an increase in your wages. Alison Pennington, chief economist at the McKell Institute, advances the argument that in fact privatisation and marketisation is driving inflation and the cost of living crisis in her recent speech at the New South Wales Teachers Federation Conference. What she is saying is that McKell Institute's findings set to be presented at this conference, the research found that while the CPI ran at an average 2.9% per year, the fastest rising costs driving total inflation were all privatised services outside the public system or services formerly delivered for free or at a low cost by a government. Among those items was gas, which, according to the McKell Institute's analysts, recorded an average annualised inflation of 5.9% over the 20-year period. Electricity, meanwhile, rose at an average of 5.7%, while medical and hospital services reported an average inflation of 5.5%. Secondary education, in which multiple private operators are active, rose by an average of 5.2%, water and sewerage by 4.6%, and housing and preschool and primary school care by 3.9%. Remembering that the overall inflation is the average is 2.9% per year. However, consumer goods such as clothing, appliances and computer equipment got cheaper over the same period, according to the report. So she says, Alison Pennington said, the analysis exposed a 20-year transfer of income from workers to private companies delivering essential services and contradicted prevailing narratives around the RBA's rate rises.
That's a very interesting research you've spoken about there, Annie. I think it again reveals the fallacies of the neoliberal thinking and privatisation, which started in the 80s, and it was we're meant to bring all these benefits, but obviously not, as per Alison Pennington's research. It seems to, the whole mantra of that privatisation was meant to make things cheaper for people. Well, it doesn't seem it's demonstrated empirically.
Well, no, if you say something three times, people will believe it. Doesn't mean it's true. Mm. And it's the same with data centres. We've gone around in circles.
Yeah.
It's NAIDOC week. It's 50 years of NAIDOC, not 50 years of the desecration of the Indigenous peoples. But I thought I'd play some songs from our Indigenous songbooks here. This is Linda's song.
She had visions and dreams and knows what it means, Lord, to try. Love.
Guinea. This is Birigan from Bulagan, coming live from the occupied territories of Gumbengi country, Nambucca Heads, New South Wales. You're listening to 3CR Radical Radio.
And you are. You're listening to Annie and Matt on Solidarity Breakfast this cold and chilly morning. And it's time for Voices for Palestine. I got this speech from outside the Melbourne Town Hall a while, not very long ago, really. It was a part of the anti-Zionist Australia demonstration out the front, and it was raining, but there was quite a few people there, and it was because the Melbourne City Council had told them that they couldn't, the night before, they couldn't hold their meeting, their last of their series on discussing Zionist principles.
Yeah, and it was a discussion that was going to be held by Veronica Shearman on Christian Zionism, and they actually found out like at about 7 o'clock on the Friday before the Sunday. So they had to quickly rush around and find an alternate venue, which they did.
Yeah.
And that's why they held their rally on, I think it was on last Tuesday. Was it last Tuesday?
Yeah. Time flies when you're having fun.
Yeah. So yeah, we've got an excerpt of the talk given by Hannah Thomas. He was the former Greens candidate in the seat of Grangler, which of course is Albo's seat. And she was a victim of police brutality. She nearly lost her eye out at one of the rallies in Sydney.
Yeah, no, yeah. Actually, one of the things, not only is she a fiery speaker, but she's actually quite small. Like, she's a small person, like a big personality, but a small physical person.
And she's spoken at quite a number of the rallies on Sunday, the Palestine rallies on Sunday.
But the thing that got me was those big burly police officers that beat her up. My God. What's going on in their minds?
Thank you. I want to acknowledge that we're on stolen Aboriginal land and sovereignty was never ceded. Empire is at its most dangerous when it's desperate and dying, and we see that in Gaza and Lebanon right now, where Israel's violence is escalating every day to more catastrophic levels. Entire neighborhoods are being reduced to rubble in scenes that evoke Hiroshima. And we saw it in the treatment of the flotilla activists, disgusting IDF soldiers raping and torturing humanitarians with zero consequence. And we see it on our screens every day with children and journalists targeted more brazenly by Israel than ever. And we see it right here as well with the lobby that's defending the genocide more desperate too. We saw them pressure Melbourne Council to cancel a room booked by a Jewish woman for a seminar about Christian Zionism for unexplained safety reasons. Zionists tried to shut it down, but like so many times, they utterly failed. It was held with a bigger crowd than ever and with zero incident. And that's the joke of it all. Every time the Zionists try and shut us down, they hand us a bigger win. We are winning, and that is why they are desperate. Every attempt to cancel an event or pressure an institution or silence a speaker is a sign of panic from the Zionist lobby. It's a desperate tactic in a war that they are already losing and that they cannot win because it is a war against the truth. The myth of Zionism and the myth of Israel are crumbling, not because of us, but under the weight of truth itself, carried by the bravest people on this earth, the journalists and ordinary people of Gaza, who somehow not only find it in them to survive the genocide, but to chronicle it in their own, in real time. And they've held up a mirror to the world. They've shown us exactly what this world has allowed, while here our own media companies still parrot the most farcical of Zionist myths of victimhood. And it is because of the courage of people in Gaza that Zionism is on borrowed time, not just in Gaza, but here as well. Because the vast majority of people in this country now see the truth, but as always, it's politicians and institutions of power that are so out of touch. The fact that more than 2.5 years into a live-streamed genocide, so many institutions still crumble like feta at the first whiff of a Zionist tantrum is pathetic and it is embarrassing. And in addition to Melbourne Council, I want to shame two institutions in particular, the University of Melbourne and St. Vincent's Health. Because I don't know if you've heard, but one of Australia's most esteemed cardiologists, Professor Peter McDonald, was due to deliver a lecture at the University of Melbourne. but they've withdrawn his invitation following pressure from the Zionist lobby about comments he made about Israel last year. Now, Professor McDonald was already subject to a formal workplace investigation into those comments, and that investigation cleared him. Despite this, the University of Melbourne and St. Vincent's cancelled his lecture, and they did not even give him a chance to respond. That decision does not just affect the professor, it deprives medical students in this country and junior doctors and health professionals of the chance to learn from one of Australia's leading experts. How dare they? How dare they come for our free speech, our healthcare, our universities, and all of it to protect a state that kills doctors and nurses and aid workers by the hundreds? But here is what they are failing to understand. None of it is working. The more they try to shut it down, the more pathetic the lobby looks. The more they try to isolate critics, the more widespread the critique becomes. We are not retreating, we are advancing. And we have already forced reversals, we have already exposed decisions that couldn't survive an ounce of public scrutiny. And that is why 87% of young Australians now hold a negative view of Israel, and across the whole population it's around 79%. The mask is well and truly off and it will never go back again. We are winning. Antoinette Latouf won, Khaled Sabsabi won, Randa Abdel Fattah has won so many times I can't even keep track. Palestine Action Group in Sydney has beaten Chris Minns in court time and time again. We will keep winning. The empire is dying and Palestine will be free.
What's taking place in Palestine is horrendous.
Here are some ways that you can keep yourself informed and involved.
Listen in to Palestine Remembered every Saturday morning at 9:30 a.m. or listen to the podcast.
Join the APAN mailing list at apan.org.au for updates, news about actions you can get involved in, and where you can donate to provide humanitarian assistance.
Listen to other news and current affairs programs on 3CR that also cover Palestine.
The oppression of the Palestinian people has been going on for 75 years. It has to stop. You can be part of making that happen by staying informed and active.
APAN is a proud supporter of 3CR.
You're with Annie and Matt on Solidarity Breakfast. I heard when I was coming in that apparently Gillian Segal wants the ABC and SBS to have more cheery stories, uplifting stories about Israel.
Yeah, I think that was reported on Thursday. That the ABC and SBS had to appear before the Royal Commission. And my understanding is that Gillian Segal is calling for an internal oversight body to be appointed to the ABC to oversee the coverage. And I think, I'm paraphrasing here, but she said things like, well, why aren't there more positive stories said about Israel? And there are other conflicts that we don't hear about, like in Africa. And I'll just point out, actually, if you go to Free Palestine Melbourne's social media on their Facebook and Instagram feed, their team of activists at Free Palestine Melbourne, they actually put together submissions to Francesca Albanese's inquiry into the media. And they actually put a very detailed overview of like what's happening at the ABC and SBS. So I can recommend that people go to the social media.
Well, that's funny because one of the events that I was going to talk about was Yasmin Johnson, a Jewish student and national co-convener of Students for Palestine, will appear before the Royal Commission into Anti-Semitism and Social Cohesion this coming Monday, the 13th of the 7th, at 12:15 p.m. with a press conference at 9 a.m. The hearing, part of the university's block, will be held at 11 Exhibition Street, Melbourne. This will be the first time that a Palestine campaign group has been granted leave to appear. So if you want to get down to Exhibition Street, 11 Exhibition Street, Monday the 13th at 9 a.m., you'll be able to hear the press conference. And are they open? Is it an open session, this whatever it's called? this Royal Commission?
I'm not sure, but I did see information on social media yesterday about it. There may be other venues where people can go and pop in and have a look at the stream.
A live stream. There's a live stream link. Yeah. So it would be you go online and get the live stream link.
And hopefully that's Yasmin's submission will be available to view later.
I'm sure they're pretty savvy, I'll have to say. This show is being serpentine and joining up and making links because after our rather disturbing analysis of McDonald's food by Jamie Oliver, we're going to move on to a conversation that I had with Helena Brent. She's the co-producer of a film called In Symbiosis. It's an award-winning feature investigating the flaws of the globalised industrial food system and proposes a roadmap to restore ecological resilience and true food security. The film is actually online at the moment as part of the Melbourne Documentary Film Festival. I have watched it and found it absolutely riveting and disturbing, I have to say. Now, Symbiosis is a big film because it's about food security and also about human connection to the natural world. So can we start with how you began this project?
So I went to study neuroscience at UCL in London. I had intended to go into research. I was convinced I would go into research. And then throughout the degree, I came across several pieces of research where I realized that there is a big disconnect between, in general, there's a big disconnect between science and the public. So a lot of the amazing independent research that is out there is not really brought to the public or communicated very inefficiently. And a lot with regard to topics surrounding nutrition and toxicology specifically. And so I thought I became very interested in this. And so a little bit more to my background, my upbringing. So I come from a rural from the countryside in Austria. And I was always exposed to, we come from a big farming family, for example. And so I was always exposed to this, to the food growing process, really. And my mom always had a garden. And so she was a keen grower. And she actually grew up with her aunt was a herbalist. She was the herbalist of the village in Poland. And so I had all these connections to growing, but it really took decades for me to get into this topic from this side. But it was all sort of sitting there in the background. And so with my degree, I realized that there's a big disconnect between science and the public. And then after I graduated with my master's, I wasn't quite sure. I knew I didn't want to go into research anymore. I thought there's something I would like to go into science communication. And at the same time, so this was in 2015, I was watching a lot of the nutritional documentaries, diet documentaries, also environmental documentaries that were coming out. And specifically with the nutrition documentaries, I always thought they're a little bit, they're confusing the public rather than giving them a solution, an empowering solution, I found. I thought they were more disempowering people rather than empowering them. Remember one of the documentaries, they were beginning to say that, you know, how bad carbohydrates are and how bad bread is for you. And I always thought, it's really interesting, none of these documentaries went into the detail of how important it is, how the ingredients to this food that we then eat.
What you're doing in your investigations, you actually go back to first principles and you look at the commercialization of food production as a method of disempowering everybody. Basically.
Exactly. So it was a real process of getting to understand all this, what our food system has actually become. And I think it's a really interesting thing, and that's why the film became quite extensive, because we began to realize. So once we started, we were watching these documentaries, and I said to my film partner Francesco, who is a cinematographer, I said to him one day, I called him after watching I don't know how many documentaries it was, but again, it was this not going back to how the food is grown and how it's processed. I thought this makes such a difference between what kind of bread you are eating. Let's just say, take bread as an example. But this is you need to look at the fundamentals of the food. And then you can make a judgment whether it's good for you or not, I think. And so I called him and I said, my God, I'm so upset. I'm so annoyed. Can we please make a documentary? He said immediately, he said, yes, let's do it. Let's do it. And we didn't know how extensive it would become, because once you start kind of pulling back curtains and you see things about the issues of food security then and all these other aspects, then you can't just close that. And you can't just say, oh, no, that's too much for this.
Yeah, we'll follow this path. You have to actually go through the whole. So let's think about how you actually covered it, because you do it in a very clear way. You decide to do case studies. You decide to talk to experts in particular fields. You follow the science. You follow the commerce. Now, each of these areas are quite deep in themselves. So how long did it take you to do the research and to write the script effectively?
To do the research, I think the research kind of started already towards the end of my degree. So probably in 2015, that's when I started to really, really look into different topics within nutrition. So that's, but actively researching into it and engaging and contacting researchers. That process probably began in 2016. And then we had our first interview in 2017. That's when we started filming. And then it was a process of, you know, with each interview, you discovered a new lead, and you may have heard something and you thought, oh, I haven't thought about this. Let me look into this. So that's how then the next interviewee came about, or a researcher may have said to me, oh, Helena, have you seen this documentary? You know, there were documentaries that were focusing on the individual topics. So there are documentaries that focus on individual topics, but I thought there wasn't one that puts everything into one. I think unless you see, you know, most of the picture, we are not covering every little detail. It's impossible. You have to make a 100-hour film.
One of the very important elements of this discussion is the scientific capture by commercial interests. So, of course, big business can pay for a large amount of research, but they're actually massaging. Some of them are massaging the topics as well as the papers in order to get a particular commercial outcome. Now, this is anathema to science, and I was thinking that some of these researchers must have felt quite a deep relief to have someone ask them questions about these issues.
Yes, absolutely. One of the comments was also that when I told them what we're trying to do, so first of all, they were very admirable of what we're trying to do and to put it all in one. And yes, they also appreciated that I come from a science background. So they understood that I will not misinterpret what they are telling me. So this was a really important aspect to get to the interviews, because I, you know, you don't just get these interviews. You are interviewed yourself to get these interviews. And each of these interviews was such a nice conversation really with these people, because they felt like they were being heard and they could really tell their story as well. And yeah, and as I said, they will not be misinterpreted. so they could talk about their research, about their experiences, because it's not just the research, it's also the experiences that are important, you know, because a lot of the researchers have field experience. So it's not just in the laboratory, you know, they've seen the real life, what's happening in the real world. And, you know, to hear all these stories is just, we were very privileged to gain access to these amazing individuals. Actually, I'm not just talking about the researchers, it's everyone, the activists, the farmers that we were able to speak to, you know, the extensive knowledge and the, you know, the emotion that they bring across, I thought was so touching for us when we were doing the interviews. And to then mold it together, it was very special, a very special process, I thought.
The line through all of it is that people in this area, people, ordinary people, but also experienced, as you said, farmers as well as the researchers, they're actually a bit frightened, aren't they? They're frightened about the future because of the commercial interests having captured the human future or the environmental future as well.
Yes, and it's currently, there are a lot of legislations that are being put in place behind the scenes while people are busy watching the World Cup and people are busy doing all kinds of things or arguing over all kinds of topics on social media. You know, there's a lot of division being sown amongst the population, I find, what I'm observing. And everybody is busy doing their thing and fighting their fights. And in the background, in the meantime, all kinds of decisions are being made about the future of our food supply. And there was just, for example, just now the EU has now deregulated. I don't know if you're aware, if you come across this, but the EU has now deregulated the plants made by the new genomic techniques. NGT1 plants, which is about 94% of all these new gene edited plants, as in the new genetically modified organisms, they will not have any safety testing, they will not have labeling, and there's no traceability. So
big business is won.
Yeah, yes. So in 2019, they tried it, and the EU Parliament said no, it still needs to be regulated under the genetic modification GMO rules, under the old GMO rules. I think lobbying has been very successful. So they kept lobbying to get this through, and it has now been pushed through. And when you speak to people, this is the interesting thing. I speak to people in Austria, where I'm from, different people in England. Nobody's heard of it because it's kept by design. It is kept out of the limelight. And nobody knows about it. There was no public consultation, really. Yes, there were different organizations have organized petitions to sign, to write to the MPs to
Well, there's always people who are keeping an eye on this particular issue. But of course, it was very hot, you know, like a decade ago or earlier. But then it's just a matter of the commercial interests. And as you point out, there's only about five companies that now control the food sources. You actually go into very specifically a broad brush history, because, of course, as people, generations of people lose the historical context, the whole business about the Green Revolution, which was basically subjugating whole areas of the Asian continent under the throes of insecticides and plant varieties that basically they've brought us to a point where they're destroying the insect worlds and the actual engine of the environment, but it's been dressed up in a way that says that it's all good and it's all about feeding populations.
It's a really interesting topic, and I think that's why it's so important to look back in history, how malnutrition and the degradation and everything, how this actually came about. Because if you don't see the causes and the real causes, you may, as an individual, when a solution is proposed, you may think, oh, this is a really good solution. Amazing. Yes, it's a good fix and it works really, they always tell you it's really quick and it's really simple. You know, these genetic modification techniques, they're not that, and they're not failure free, by the way.
Well, no, they see that as a commercial advantage, because if something fails, then they come up with another commercial solution. And as you talk about malnutrition, America is a perfect example, of course, because a whole lot of people have things to eat, but they're malnourished.
Yes, exactly. There's no nutritional value in these foods anymore. That the aim was always to bring the background into it, because it's meant to educate people on being able to make an informed decision and being able to see whether something that is proposed as a solution is actually a true solution, because you always need to look at it in a life cycle, in its whole, how does it fit into the environment, and not just with regard to the environment, but how does it fit into society? Does it actually give people a tool, you know, does it belong to people? Does it give people does it empower them, or does it make them dependent? Are they going to be independent? Are they going to be free to choose whatever they want? Or is it going to catch them in a vicious cycle of dependency?
Symbiosis is showing at the Melbourne Documentary Film Festival. Are you showing it in other places? Because it's actually a very good summary of the issues that are facing the world. And I think that you have succeeded very well, to tell you the truth. So are you taking it all around the place?
Well, we're currently trying to get it via, you know, to get it to distribution, basically. So at the moment, it's in the Documentary Festival. But it's lined up to go into distribution.
You've done a good job, especially since filmmaking isn't your first skill base. It's a big story, but you've done it in an efficient way, as well as a very personable way, so people that can understand what are the grand issues, but also the personal issues. And I agree with you. It's the business about agency, humans believing that outside forces can come up with answers, and as well as the manipulation of the message, when it's about something so intrinsic to human and the natural world.
Francesco Gallo, my co-director, I just wanted to say that with regard to that you said we did a good job. He's an amazing cinematographer, and he's done an amazing job filming, and we edited it also together, and it was always our wish to give a voice to those people who don't get much of a voice. And that was really important, and the human aspect. So we really pursued on this. And I think because we are truly independent, I think this was possible, because I think if you're not truly independent, then all kinds of opinions will come together. And for us, it was so important to stay independent and to really be able to bring this message across.
The state Labor government has begun works on demolishing Melbourne's 44 public housing towers to be replaced with private housing. Already hundreds of residents have been displaced, often into unsuitable homes under duress.
The towers on Racecourse Road, Flemington, have become Homes Victoria work sites, while the families still living in the buildings are being treated appallingly.
Join Save Public Housing supporters in solidarity with residents.
Weekdays 7:30 till 9 a.m. as we engage with passing traffic to make some noise and show Jacinta Allen
that the demolition of public housing is unacceptable. Signs and banners provided, or bring your own.
There's power in numbers, so see you at 120 Racecourse Road, Flemington, 7:30 till 9 a.m.
Safe Public Housing is a 3CR supporter.
A weak solidarity Bricky team listener when big Supremo Anthony Albanese hurried home from sealing a few train killer protection rackets across the Pacific, our Pacific family. Why, he even acknowledged they face the odd problem with climate change, if there is such a thing, like disappearing into the briny. Sensibly, he didn't actually offer to do anything about it, like stop sinking them. Hurried home to greet his very, very close friend, Narendra Democracy Ra Imodi, promising Narendra Democracy Ra an endless supply of True Blue Aussie uranium. And given True Blue Aussie has signed up to spend trillions buying US of the UN of the US of the world nuclear waste, just another way of observing our aversion to the non-nuclear proliferation treaty we support, other than trillions to accept US of nuclear waste and providing nuclear-armed India with the wherewithal, which will require True Blue Aussie to open up even more uranium mines. But that's what good friends are for. And of course, following that report last week outlining heaps of abuses of human rights by True Blue Aussie, from terra nullius non-land, non-people relations, terra nullius children, jailing children generally, locking up and deporting asylum seekers, a litany of abuses, a sensible, unstated agreement for neither Anthony nor Narendra Democracy to mention the other's record on human rights. Notice there weren't that many Islamic Indians joining the deific adulation. In fact, none. And how dare the iconoclastic Greens use Parliament House itself to show the program outlining Narendra Democracy's modi operandi of oppressing Muslims, oppressing minorities, and silencing any media opposition that is quite sensibly banned from being shown in India. On climate change, of which Lord Rupert of Wapping knows there is no such thing, his Wapping sin was aghast with breathless shock as it revealed the socialists plan to spend $20,000 a head to send, quote, climate campaigners to cop that Mother Earth 31 in Turkey. A UN of the US of the UN of the world talk fest, according to Lord Rupert. A disgusting abuse of taxpayer dollars, he quoted in the opening par. A quote from no less an authority than One Nation, which, like Lord Rupert knows, there is no such thing, and also attacked by the coalition, which also knows. Worse, the delegation will have an emphasis on sending terra nullius non-land, non-people to be housed in, quote, a luxury Turkish beachside resort. Surely a few humpies out the back would make them feel like they'd never left home. Now, 20 grand for a climate change talk fest pales against the daily costs of subsidising the very industries whose disregard for Mother Earth prompts the talk fest in the first place, and who turn up in huge numbers to ensure COP that Mother Earth remains a toothless talk fest. Well, when there's a dollar or billions involved, Mother Earth must take a back seat, like with Canada Supremo Mark Carney. No, he can't. Former UN OB, Special Envoy on Climate Action and Finance, and creator of the Glasgow Financial Alliance for Net Zero, and now the finance bid has won the day. Mark has approved a 998-kilometre, let's say 1,000-kilometre, oil and gas pipeline from Alberta oil sands to a port near Vancouver. We can't afford to restrain the growth of an important part of our energy mix, oil and gas, to meet a short-term goal, Mark explained. Short-term, presumably, protecting Mother Earth. See, it's the economy, stupid. But he displayed his environmental credentials. We are going to produce our conventional oil and gas in the most environmentally sustainable ways. Sure, sure, most reassuring. Although, the most environmentally sustainable way would be... oh, no, no, the economy, the economy. And more good news, while other states are mouthing that their clamour to attract energy and water-hungry data centres will encourage the tech behemoths to supply renewable energy, Queensland Supremo David Crisafulov says he won't even put up a pretense. It's fossils, fossils, fossils. And in a big week for the planet, what a surprise. US of big Supremo Donald Trump or the poor has abandoned all renewable tax credits that encouraged renewable proposals Donald knows could hurt the fossils. speaking of in the week that was sport, a sensation at the World Cup, with the Belgian team and its officials all rounded up and locked up in the same prison as Venezuelan Supremo Maduro and his wife, charged with unsportsperson-like treason, although Donald naturally called it unsportsmanlike, which would upset our big Supremo Anthony Albanese, whose stated support for women was apparent this week. The greatest sporting travesty ever, ever, Donald informed us. Worse, Donald said, they won't even allow him to defend the USO by handing him Greenland. But that's Denmark, Mr. Supremo, a lackey corrected him. Now, naturally, an ex-lackey sacked on the spot. Same thing, they're all scum, the worst scum ever, ever, announcing he would seek the death penalty for the Belgian football criminals and impose a 585% tariff on all Belgian imports. Upset that a left-wing scum commie judge had overruled his quite proper proposal that people born in the US of migrants have their constitutional right to US of citizenship quashed. Perhaps a touch oblivious to the minor fact that the very US of soccer player he had reinstated by his sycophantic friends, who will stay friends as long as they stay sycophantic, is just such a US of citizen, who would have been banned if Donald's proposal had succeeded. So Donald, thank the left-wing scum commie judge. But surely he could have asked his FIFA mate Gianni anything you asked to overturn the result and declare the US of the winner. Instead, what disrespect. The Belgian defence minister in Ankara for that NATO talk fest posted, our defence is better than yours, backed by ABBA's The Winner Takes It All. What gross disrespect. The world is waiting with bated to learn who will win the second FIFA Peace Prize. Don't tell us there won't be a second. Surely after another year of war is peace, Donald could double up. But of course the World Cup will be over and FIFA can move on, albeit its reputation for integrity in tatters. The good news for Donald is that on the odd occasion he gets together with Anthony Albanese, they can have laugh after laugh after laugh, telling each other their blokesy stories about their sex lives and conquests. Then, when the microphones are under their noses, tell us how much they just respect women. Then again, they are screwing their countries for the poorest of the poor. But the balance makes it all worthwhile. They're making life even cosier for the filthiest rich of the filthy rich. In the Don's case, including himself and his family. He also expressed his admiration for Turkey autocrat, or sorry, Supremo, Recep Erdogan power, mostly described as strongman. Ah, Recep, Donald sought advice, perhaps for the first time ever, ever. How do you keep getting elected without any opposition? Simple, lock the opposition up. For what? Usually corruption, treason, sacrilege. You can always think of something. Trouble is these left-wing scum-cummy judges keep overturning my omnipotence. Whether Donald recognised the contradiction in that comment, we don't know, but his mate, brackets temporary, for all Donald's mates are temporary, because eventually they all make a mistake at the altar of, pointed out you have to appoint your mates on the guarantee that if they do not rule in your favour, they join the opposition in the cells. Thanks, Recep. I've always thought our old mate Vlad has the best solution ever, ever. Simply kill the opposition. By week's end, it was difficult to decipher who were the worst left-wing scum commies of all, the Belgian footy team, US of judges, or the people of Iran. As Donald continued to balance between resolution is so close and total destruction of Iranian civilization. Total destruction on top, while the world economy continues to suffer thanks to the hubris of Donald and his very, very close friend Benjamin Not Another Yahoo, brackets temporary, who continues his slaughter, destruction, genocide and starvation across the Middle East. Caring business class party Supremo and would-be big Supremo, Angus Tailings, claimed one notion would deliver a debt bomb. The national debt, Angus. No, my job. One notion's that appalling Hoonside is currently traipsing around Europe preaching to conservative conferences, bringing us to reform fascism's British hope Nigel Farage the debts, resigning so he can rerun over a few millions in donations he just forgot to declare. The people versus the establishment he did declare, and that his only opponent looks like being a garbage bin, seems totally appropriate. Speaking of opposition, St. Kevin's College knows how to handle a problem. Must say St. Kevin is an excellent name, but Professor Anthony Dixon, suing for sexual abuse back in 1973, was sent a solicitor's letter from the school banning him from attending his 50th year reunion. That'll teach him. G8 Education, also hit by allegations of child abuse, was hit this week with allegations that it underpaid more than 1,400 workers more than $2 million. Mainly due to the individual flexibility arrangements caring employers so love. Win-win. Well, win-win-win for the caring employers. At a Geelong bakery, which has operated under several nomenclatures and gone broke several times, bloke called Paul Field discovered it owed its workers about $100,000 in unpaid super and admits there's not much chance of them ever seeing the money. Being a caring employer is so difficult, isn't it? Finally, spare a thought for the poor Troubler Aussie Education Union officials whose deal stitched up with the government has come unstitched through unreasonable workers who think the rank and file should have a say. Groups like Fight the Crisis and Socialists in Schools. Socialists in Schools, doesn't that say it all? Don't they know they have a socialist state government with nothing but the workers' interests at heart? Good morning.
People are where they are. You're going to have to meet them where they are. And you're going to have to be generous. And that's why it comes back to the idea of friendship. Friendship is never with people who are just like you. What a boring world it would be if you only made friends with people identical to yourself. You know, then again, you might as well have imaginary friends. You want to learn from people. You want to laugh with them. You want to laugh at their limitations, they laugh at your limitations, you grow together, yeah? So, politics is also like that. If you're just stagnant, you know, if somebody enters politics age 15 and when they are 35, the same person, terrible. They haven't grown, they haven't shaped themselves. I'm Vijay Prashad with 3CR. You better listen to it because it's really good.
Uncle James Williams at 7 p.m. Saturday, July the 25th at Moonee Valley Bowls Club at Ormond Park for the official launch of his campaign for Essendon with the Greens for the state election in November. Hear Uncle James speak about taxing the rich, housing, climate action and a stronger future for everyone. Meet local supporters, enjoy music and conversation and be part of a positive movement for change. All are welcome. Come along, bring your family and help launch a campaign built on respect, community and hope. The Australian Greens Victoria are a 3CR supporter.
So proud and tall, I remember stories when
little girl hid out by the sleigh.
Lovely rendition of Narrandiri Woman by Ruby Hunter. I hadn't heard that version of it. It was lovely. You're on Solidarity Breakfast with Annie and Matt. And we've come to the last part of the program, and it's an important piece. It's a chat I had with the two co-conveners of Farah. Do you know Farah at all?
No, Annie, can you give a bit more information?
Yeah, Friends of Australian Rock Art. They're the group that's credited with securing National Heritage listing for the Murujunga Rock Art in 2007 over in Western Australia, which is being threatened by the extension of the Woodside giant LNG export facility until 2070, given by the federal government. The trigger for a legal assessment of the project at the Commonwealth level under the EPBC Act was the National Heritage listing of the area secured in 2007. I got to chat with Susan Swain and Judith Hugo. They're coming over for next week because on the 21st of July there's a federal court case is opening up to dispute the federal government's decision to allow the extension. Just before we get to the conversation that I had with the two conveners, they've got an event at the State Library on the 19th, Sunday the 19th of July. It's got an action-packed group of people talking about the issues, and it's called The Endangered Rock Art of Murujunga. Can it survive? It's going to be at the State Library of Victoria, Sunday the 19th of July, 2 p.m. to 4 p.m. If you want to find more information or get tickets, www.fara.com.au. This is the chat I had with the two women.
My name's Judith Hugo, and I'm co-convener of Fred Berlin Rock Art, along with Susan Swain. We're both co-conveners. And Farah, that's Friends of Australian Rock Art, has been fighting to protect, preserve and promote this ancient rock art of Murujunga ever since 2006. And luckily in 2007, we managed to get National Heritage listing for it by Malcolm Turnbull, who was the Environment Minister at the time. And that, by doing that, has ensured that today we can bring this case in the federal court where it will be heard under the EPBC Act, which is designed to protect national heritage listed places. doesn't matter whether they're World Heritage listed, but National Heritage listing is the key, is the trigger in this case. So we're very thrilled to have been able to have done that way back in 2007. And our case is about to be heard in the federal court.
Now, the reason for why you've told us the legal trigger, now it's obvious that it's taken a long, you're playing the long game, because otherwise it wouldn't be possible for the people of Australia to defend this heritage, because the federal government would just make a decision and move ahead. This is really important work that you've been doing.
Yes, well, the federal government has gone ahead and made this very controversial decision without considering that the National Heritage listing gives us even more protection for the rock art. So that is really what we're contesting in our legal case, which will be heard from the 21st to the 24th of July in the federal court. We're also contesting that Minister Watt did not consider all the facts that were before him, that he certainly did not consider sufficiently the scientific evidence that the rock art was being destroyed by chemical emissions from industry. And we hope that we're actually having a judicial review, and hoping that this will be on what our case turns, is the fact that he didn't make... he made a very flawed decision at the time.
The minister failed in his duty to consider the full range of economic impacts of the proposal and improperly relied on economic benefits claimed by Woodside in allowing the project to proceed despite its ongoing impacts on the rock art. That's what you're claiming. Does that imply that the government appears to be a little bit captured by Woodside's advice rather than doing their own advice? It's not independent?
Well, it's interesting that in WA, when it came up for the Minister for the Environment to approve it, and it was approved, you have the right of public appeal. And in WA, we had 776 written submissions to the appeals convener saying, this is the wrong decision. It shouldn't be approved. But they ignored all that. They approved it and then passed that approval to Minister Watt, who then took it as, well, if Woodside and WA say it's good to go, I'm going to give it the tick of approval as well, in spite of public discussion saying it should actually be looked at again and again and again because it hasn't met the criteria of a place that is preserved for culture. It's the fact that they just ignore that amazing 1 million piece of rock art and that gallery of heritage culture that is there that is just being destroyed by the emissions from industry on the borough.
The other thing about it is that inappropriate considered Woodside's claims regarding the technical feasibility of the measures to reduce acid gas. I mean, the minister doesn't deny that there will be an impact, but he seems to think that he relies on Woodside's so-called technical overview as if they aren't self-interested.
This is where the argument comes in, that he's considered their economic interests over the cultural heritage, because the original conditions that he put before them and were contested very strongly by Woodside over quite a few weeks. Their main contention was that they didn't want the expense of having to put emissions reduction technology onto their plant because it would be expensive. And so they managed to convince him that it would not be financially viable for them. And so in that case, he decided that their economic benefits were what should be considered over and above the huge cultural significance of this rock art. I mean, it's 50,000 years old. It's there are about 2 million pieces. But it's the most important thing about the rock art is it's not just a single event in a country's history, like the pyramids in Egypt, or like the Lascaux Caves, or like Stonehenge. This is a continual record of humankind's existence over 50,000 years. And it's very interesting to see in the carvings in the rock art reflect this, because during the last ice age, when the waters were right out, the carvings were of terrestrial mammals, and some of them were actually prehistoric mammals, which are now disappeared. But as the waters came back in, about 17,000 years ago, they changed, and you've got a lot more marine creatures which were depicted, like sharks and crabs and dugongs and things like that. So it's the only place in the world where there is a 50,000-year record of humankind survival from one particular climate scenario to another.
You know, it takes my breath away that we have a minister that would say, given what you've just said, that the taking of the action, despite proposed avoidance and mitigation measures, is likely to result in residual impacts to the values of the National Heritage Place. However, he considers the impacts were outweighed by the social or economic factors. It's the most incredible, short-sighted understanding of the importance of this gallery of work.
Yes, and the fact that he uses the term residual impact gives you the impression that it's very minimal. But in fact, if Woodside will not adapt emissions reduction technology, which is used in these sort of industries right around the world, the rock art will continue to be damaged until 2070, which is where the extension has been allowed to. And there won't be any left. It'll be totally destroyed by then. And in fact, it's interesting reading the minister's statement of reasons. He says that he recognises the significance of the rock art, that it's the oldest and everything else. He also realises, through scientific matter before him, that it is possible to mitigate the impact of emissions on the rock art. But he said, in consideration of Woodside's economic rationale, I rather fall on the side of Woodside's case. So, you know, he really digs himself into... he shoots himself in the foot, because he says, I recognise everything and I recognise it can be mitigated, but I'll let Woodside carry on with its damage.
It's just incredibly shocking. FARA is a voluntary organisation, isn't it? And it means that all the different people that have and skills that have been brought together to bear to defend what should be not even need to be defended, in fact, but which is so valuable that a whole group of people have come together. That's correct, isn't it?
Yes, we were a very small voluntary organisation. There are only 10, 11 of us on the committee, but we've been working very hard, and with help from various environmental consultants, and now with an amazing legal team, which is Johnson Legal out of Sydney, and a very, very formidable group of barristers, we have formulated this very, very strong case, which we feel has very, very reasonable grounds for success.
But the other interesting thing is we have had a UN special rapporteur asked to join our case, because she said no longer can people around the world approve emitting projects without understanding the ramifications of that on climate change for the whole world. And so the UN Special Rapporteur had to ask the judge, could she be included in the case? And over objections from Woodside, yes, she was admitted. And so we have an international overview of the significance of this case, of how important this decision is worldwide.
The case is starting in Melbourne. The federal court case is starting in Melbourne on July the 21st. You've also got legal action going on in Western Australia, which is going to happen later. But this case in Melbourne, you are also have a seminar going on the 19th of July to prepare people so that people can understand some of the ramifications. Do you want to talk a little bit to my listeners about that particular seminar, which is going to be at the State Library?
Yes, as you say, it'll be on Sunday the 19th at 2 o'clock. We have a stellar lineup of speakers. We have Raylene Cooper, who's a Murujuga custodian, who's coming over to be with us. We also have Ken Malvaney, who's the world expert on the Murujuga rock art and has been working alongside us for many years. Then there's John Black, who arrived, came up on a tour to the Burrup and was absolutely horrified at what he saw with industry growing right in the midst of all this rock art, this fragile surface of the rock art. And he is the one who did a lot scientific investigation to show categorically that it was being destroyed, but of course the government won't listen to that. And then we have Piers Verstegen, who is an environmental consultant, and he will talk about not only the impact to the rock art, but also the implications for climate change, which are very huge, and that really should be considered. But the time has come now where fossil fuel industries have to really be responsible for their emissions, because with them being allowed to increase by government approval, they are contributing more and more to greenhouse gases. And as we know, the horrendous results of climate change, the floods, the increasing heat, the bushfires and rising tides, rising waters and coral bleaching, everything is the result of, with the oceans warming, is the result of climate change. And so he will bring that very much to the fore as well. So we urge you, please come. This is a very important lecture that will give you an amazing insight into why Murujuga is so special and so desperately needs protecting.
Well, people can get tickets and more information by going to www.fara.com.au. It's interesting, isn't it, that the federal government minister should be talking about balancing social and economic issues against the integrity of the gallery of rock art. But in actual fact, what's at stake is actually climate change and other aspects as well, which are incredibly expensive in terms of the economy and society. The capture of our federal government and state governments by fossil fuel industry is quite alarming, actually.
Yes, and of all the states, WA is the most captured state, because our premier just does the bidding of Woodside. So, you know, it's time that ridiculous partnership was broken, because it's not doing Australia or our people or the world any good at all. And the time has come, and that's why we're going to court.
Thank you very much for talking to me, both of you.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, Annie.
Yeah, my grandma told me all about things that happened here when white men came into this land, or blacks lived in fear. Not all the whites were bad to them, but there were quite a few. The terrible things they did to them was red, white and blue. They took young girls away on boats and made them work for naught. And sometimes the soldiers and settlers would kill the blacks for sport. Now here on mainland Tassie where the fighting got so bad, to think of all the killings, it really makes me sad.
Hello, this is Maluma May from Bulligan and you're listening to 3CR.
And it's the end of the program, Matt. How do you feel?
Yeah, that was a really fascinating interview with the co-conveners of FARA and what's going on at the Murujuga rock art and their legal fight.
They're fighting the good fight for everybody. Yeah, it's just unreal.
It's unbelievable. And as you said, Annie, it's just another example of the government being under the capture of industry. It's pretty disgusting.
Yeah, it's pretty disgusting. Before we go, there's a couple of events to tell you about, some fundraisers from some of the programs at 3CR to reach our total for the Radiothon. There's going to be a Uprise Radio 2026 Radiothon trivia fundraiser at Hard Out Bar in Preston.
It's on Plenty Road, Preston.
Yep, and it's Wednesday the 22nd of July at 6:30 p.m. You should go to humanitix.com/uprise-trivia to be on one of the tables. It's per person booking, so there's going to be tables of four people, and there should be, I think this will be a hot ticket. It will be really good fun. They are a lot of fun, and you can test your political savvy and trivia. Also, Urban Voices has a night on Saturday, the 25th of July, Radio Bar, 357 Brunswick Street, Fitzroy, 7 p.m. to late, both pushing for a... another 50 years for 3CR. So if that's the sort of thing you like to do, then buy a ticket and get along. There's also, it does conflict, I'll have to say, but Justice for Chimane, 19th of July at 2 p.m. at the front of the State Library. Important, it's Chimane, a village in the Tamil homeland near Jaffna, has become one of the most significant mass grave sites in Sri Lanka. More than 426 bodies have so far been uncovered, with investigations continuing. Following the genocidal actions of the Sri Lankan state, Sri Lanka became one of the countries with the highest numbers of enforced disappearances in the world. Today, the truth is emerging as our loved ones are being unearthed from mass graves across the Tamil homeland. There is a commemoration out the front on 19th of July, 2 p.m. in front of the State Library. Perhaps you can doff your hat as you go into the other event inside. I'm sure neither realised that they were in conflict in terms of time. There's also an anniversary that you pointed out that's important to for us to remember. Rainbow Warrior.
Yeah, back on the 10th of July, 1985... the French government blew up the Greenpeace vessel Rainbow Warrior, which was surveilling and gathering evidence of the French government's nuclear bomb testing in Imura Atoll.
Yeah, and the thing about it, of course, is that ugly head of nuclear power obviously is still raising its head as the Australian government likes to shake hands with Modi over uranium. So... it's mark the fight. It continues. We'll go out with Down City Streets. And coming up next is Asia Pacific
Currents.
Down City Streets, I would roam. I had no bed, I had no home. Thank you.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.